Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. With us today, we have Leanne Buchanan. Leanne is the president and CEO of the Miami-Dade Innovation Authority. Leanne, welcome to the podcast.
Christian, thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. So let's start with Miami-Dade. What's the authority's mandate?
That's a great question. So MDIA, as we call it, because it's a bit of a mouthful, is actually the first public innovation authority in the US. And what we focus on is helping municipalities or local governments fast track how they pilot and procure emerging technologies. And we're focused on the types of technologies that help them improve quality of life. So technologies that help with mobility, housing, healthcare, sustainability, as we think about some of the more challenging effects of the changing relationship to the environment. And also the types of technologies that reduce the friction that governments experience or that people experience in interacting with government. And so that is kind of the big idea behind our work. We are looking at helping local government be more effective in service delivery, but to do so more efficiently. And that's reimagining how they use innovation and technology to do so.
How many years has the authority been operating?
So MDIA is relatively new. We're actually about to celebrate our 2-year anniversary of our programmatic launch. And essentially what we do to help local governments is we run public innovation challenges. So if you're familiar with the RFP process or request for proposal process, that's the way in which government buys services or buys things. And we flip that on its head by working with departments to say, let's refine the problem. Let's put the problem out to the market. And then we can find and cast a wider net to find technology from all around the world that can help solve the discrete problem faster and better than would traditionally happen through an RFP process.
Makes great sense. And so how has the experience evolved over the last 2 years?
So it's evolved in a really interesting way. And I'll tell you, when I was first tapped to take this idea and build an organization around it, my thought was we were exclusively focused on helping to clear the pathway to revenue-based growth for startups. We quickly realized that our work also requires us to focus heavily on how we make sure that local government can be a catalyst for commercializing technology by looking at the way in which it engages with startups, removing some of the choke points and barriers that make it very difficult for organizations like startups to even work with government. And so I think one of the biggest ways that we've changed or we've evolved is we're actually an investor. We're a nonprofit, but we invest money in startups. And the way that we invest is when we run these public innovation challenges, like with the airport or the seaport or with solid waste, we invest $100,000 in each of the winning companies, 3 to 4 winners per challenge, to help them defray the cost of their pilot. And then we help to facilitate their pilot. So we increase the likelihood of success by working with both sides to really get the best out of a pilot opportunity to show that that startup can do what it says it can do. And so that's been the biggest kind of evolution, is thinking we were focused on startups and now realizing we need to focus on the system or local government to make it easier for startups to play.
Interesting. How many cohorts are you running a year?
So we don't run cohorts, but we do have challenges. Since we've launched about 18 months ago, almost 2 years ago, we have had 5 public innovation challenges. And it's really interesting topics, Christian, which I actually never thought I would see myself working on these types of issues. So our first challenge was around how to find technologies or innovative solutions to repurpose sargassum seaweed. Now, I didn't even know what sargassum seaweed was, but now it's kind of hit the national waves because in the Southeast United States in particular, and most of the Caribbean. It's that annoying brown seaweed that makes it really icky when you go to the beach. Now, instead of that organic matter ending up in a landfill or just being placed in a certain location to decompose, we found startups that are turning that material through a circular economy methodology into things like fertilizer, organic fertilizer, taking some of the biopolymers and using that into other products, turning it into building materials, drying it out and making it into more sustainable packaging materials. So that's just one example of many that we have been able to work on with the Miami-Dade County partners.
Wow. So I heard the evolution is the realization that it sounds like, I don't know if buying is the right word, but interaction with the local governments has been key to success. Have there been any, have there been challenges of bringing them on board? And then do you find yourself having to deal with conflicting agendas interagency?
Yeah, that's a super great question. So MDIA was actually co-founded by the mayor of Miami-Dade County and her then chief of economic innovation and development. And the mayor went to Israel and saw the Israeli Innovation Authority and was really interested to see, can we replicate a vehicle that would allow government to play an active role in the technology ecosystem in a way that was unique to government. And that was kind of the vision behind our work. And so I shared that anecdote to really frame that because we've got buy-in, if you will, because MDIA is created in partnership with government, we're not a consultant, kind of not an outside agency that has its own agenda, we're a nonprofit. We have experienced, I think, less friction than a traditional organization would experience because we've got the cover, we've got the support of leadership from the very top down. But that's not to say that there aren't natural friction points. I think when you're looking at legacy organizations, organizations that are heavily bureaucratic, organizations like government that has a different agenda around how it operates because it has to answer to the public trust. It has to be accountable to public resources and funding. There are different types of complexities that come into play when interacting with government. And what we've realized is what allows us to do our work effectively is to understand what is the readiness level of our departments that we're working with or municipality. And you've worked with startups, and so you know there's a standard in the startup industry called TRL, which is the technical readiness level. That's something that NASA created in the 70s to understand how mature is this product, how mature is this company, so we can benchmark how we interact with them. So what MDIA has started to create and realize is government itself, from a departmental level up to a larger municipality, they have innovation readiness levels, what we call a public innovation readiness level, that helps us assess where are we going to experience challenges, where are we going to be able to relieve some of the friction and tension. And that bears out into like five different things: readiness to pilot, culture of leadership, those internal champions, track record of even dealing with innovation. Is it innovation that's performative or is it innovation that drives outcomes? Whether or not there is a focus on economic efficiencies, because innovation these days, when budgets are tight, has to actually be able to have measurable efficiencies. And then most importantly, looking at overall the structure. Do they have an infrastructure in place to do innovation? And so that's something that has helped us both assess but effectively respond to the nuanced ways in which working with government to innovate can actually be fun and effective.
Wow. Really impressed with the structure that you laid out. And it sounds actually exciting, which you don't normally associate with governments. So high five. Earlier you mentioned identifying problems and searching the globe for solutions. Is there though a preference for companies who may have a footprint in Florida or Miami-Dade?
That's a really good question. I think if you can support local and homegrown companies, that's always a preference. When we look at the data across the last five challenges that we've run starting in July of 2023, we've been able to identify 444 companies that hail from 55 different countries, 19 states, but then about 30% of the companies that apply have some type of connection to the state of Florida. And what's interesting, though, is we think that our approach of these pilot-based open innovation challenges is kind of creating a new paradigm to make government find solutions faster and better, because we're casting a wider net, as I mentioned. When we look at the national data, the average amount of responses that a municipality or government entity would get to an RFP is around 5, maybe upwards of 10 if it's really exciting. We see well over, I think our lowest challenge had like 60 responses, highest challenge had 136. So we're exponentially increasing the selection pool that our challenge hosts, those departments that we work with, have to find really great solutions. And from an investor perspective, when we look at this data on how well these companies are doing as a cohort, those 444 companies represent $6.5 billion in revenue and about $2 billion in funding raised, and about 44,000 employees. So when we're looking at economic impact, that is also even more significant than the traditional process.
Wow. If we could take a moment, take a step back, would love to hear your career progression leading up to MDIA.
Yeah. So I am a recovering attorney that I say really fondly, because I still have a law license, which I think I worked really hard for, and studying for the bar is no joke. So definitely keep that active. But I moved into a new career focus about a decade ago. And so I would say my body of work, which exists outside of MDIA, is really focused on how can leaders use technology, innovation, and new forms of social investment to either unlock opportunity for individuals. Those could be individuals that are looking for, you know, social economic mobility. They could be startups that are looking for opportunities to scale, or transforming communities writ large. Now, at MDIA, that's at an ecosystem level, and some of my old roles were focused on really growing the technology and innovation ecosystem. And what's been interesting about this particular personal mission is it's allowed me to be flexible. I've been at the helm of launching and leading a really diverse portfolio of social impact initiatives that align under that umbrella, but do very different things, from launching MDIA, which is focused on helping government innovate more effectively and find new technologies to improve outcomes for constituents, to, you know, my own nonprofit, which uses technology to provide college strategy coaching for under-resourced students and has helped students win about $40 million in scholarships, to other projects like, you know, Tech Equity Miami, which recently rebranded its name to Momentum Miami, which is a philanthropics funders consortium that helps funders in our region direct their resources in an aligned way, and has helped deploy about $75 million in philanthropic capital to projects that use technology to create better outcomes for community. So that's a little bit more of my background. I think that my personal purpose in life is really about helping people see themselves and the world around them through the lens of pure potential, which means at my heart, I am an innovator.
I love it. May I ask what type of law you practice?
So I practice complex commercial litigation with a little bit of white collar defense. So I was a litigator, trial lawyer. My firms that I worked at, we tried cases in state and federal courts.
Wow. Well, my next question was going to be, you know, was there a defining moment where that set you on this path to, you know, effectively, and it sounds like enabling communities to realize their full potential?
I actually think there was a defining moment. So I actually wanted to be a lawyer since I was 4 years old, and I'm in the final process of getting my book out, which will be out later on this fall, which is all about innovators. But I talk about the story in my book because that's your identity. My identity was always to become a lawyer. I became a lawyer. I did it. And then one summer, I was on a leadership experience through my nonprofit, the NEA Project, where we help clear the pathway to college through college strategy coaching and leadership experiences in Africa and Southeast Asia. And on one of these fellowship experiences, I asked my students, what is the thing that you're most proud of? What is the thing that like makes you most excited about the impact that you're having on the world? And I'm the only one asking questions. At that point, a student turned the question on me and said, Miss Leanne, what about you? And I realized it wasn't my law practice. It was actually the organization, the nonprofit that I had built that had allowed me to play a small part in changing the trajectory of people's lives. And so that was kind of the defining moment that said, maybe I should be doing something a little bit different where I can see the tangible impact of my talents and what I'm doing. And don't get me wrong, you see really great results when you win a case and you're able to achieve a particular outcome for a client. But I think it pales in comparison to building things that are really changing people's lives or changing how government interacts with people or just giving organizations access to the capital that they need to scale their impact.
I love it. I am curious though, 4 years old, what do you remember what it was that said, I'm going to be a lawyer?
I don't remember if it was a combination of, you know, like what you see on TV. I always thought that the lawyers seemed to command a great deal of respect and they always seemed to be the smartest people in the room. And then I think the other part is culturally, like I'm a, you know, I'm like a third culture kid. I'm the first generation of my family to be living outside of Jamaica. And I think with a lot of immigrants, you know, education is the ultimate pathway to opportunity. And I think, you know, becoming a lawyer, one of these really well-regarded professions, you get these kind of silent winks and silent affirmations that when you say, oh, I want to be a lawyer, people are like, okay, yeah, that's the direction you should go in. So I think it was a combination of exposure plus affirmation in my family environment that definitely fueled that decision at such an early age.
I think that makes great sense. And to your credit, you're extremely articulate and you did a really amazing job of conveying your position and what you're doing. So I can see the dots here. Fast forward to today, what's your larger vision for MDIA? How does it continue to build on the momentum that you've garnered over nearly 2 years?
So MDIA, and I think this goes back to one of your early questions about what did you know now that you didn't know then. We've realized that MDIA represents a vehicle or a model that's missing in many municipalities. A lot of municipalities and governments, they want to innovate. They have some ideas of what they want to see, but they're missing that flywheel, this kind of wash, rinse, repeat blueprint of how to do that consistently and in a way that actually generates impact or measurable outcomes. And I keep saying measurable because there's a lot of things that are great, like media moments, but when push comes to shove, can you actually show how you move the needle for constituents? And so what we're excited about at MDIA is to bring the model that we've incubated here in South Florida, in Miami, to other cities. And when we see like some of the wins that I didn't know was important, but when we talk about procurement, which is like this boring subject, we've been able to reduce the procurement cycle for pilot timelines down 67% in Miami-Dade County. We have been able to demonstrate that in most cases, through our process, we can go from selection to pilot in less than 6 months. Now, we learned that before MDIA, it takes about 18 months for anything to happen, even as close as a pilot. And so being able to shrink that timeline down by 2/3, that represents time saving, cost saving, efficiencies. And that is what governments are tasked with. How do we do less with more? How do we demonstrate that we are good stewards of this system, of this vehicle, of the funds that fuel how government is delivering services? And so that's why we're really excited, because other municipalities are like, oh, wow, you can actually fast track procurement. You are getting us better and exponentially more choices than the traditional RFP. You're able to do things more nimbly. You're able to bring new solutions like AI, machine learning, different types of platforms into government at a faster rate. That sounds like something we want, and that's what we've been hearing.
I'm curious as I'm listening, one of the things that I, or there's a trend of around transparency that I think is taking place throughout the country, if not the world. And I think one of the effects that it has is that it has enabled to get people in an organization to get the sands out of the gears because you can more easily identify where choke points are. If you, has that been your experience? Has that been a contributing factor to the speed of reducing these cycles?
So I think it's less about transparency and more about process. Traditionally, processes are how government can standardize what it does, and sometimes it may not see that it could be done more efficiently. And so there's definitely transparency to our process, but I think trust, the trust that we engender in partnering as an embedded partner with our different departments that we work with, that is actually what accelerates the speed by which we're able to do things, because they see that you've had success with one department. Now let's try it with this department. We bring them a completely different way of approaching the problem that they hadn't thought of, but they can see how effective it can be. And I think the other piece that really helps us accelerate the process is we're shifting culture. So our culture is really, the traditional startup culture. We move fast, we don't break things, but we're agile. And we don't get stuck by these hierarchical structures. We're there to kind of break those down. And so we give our partners cover because we're collaborating with them to be able to do things that they would not have traditionally done. And because we have the buy-in of the director and the mayor level, they also feel empowered to move faster and move differently.
I have not worked at the municipality level before, but I'll presume there's some degree of perception of just governments in general that, as you're pointing out, they don't necessarily always move as quick as we want them to. Do you find, have you been, has there been a deliberate attempt then to shift that culture, or do you find that just the process itself is created in these efficiencies?
So those five factors of readiness to innovate that I mentioned, one of them is culture, and it starts with identifying who are your internal champions, and then identifying what are the psychological barriers and what are the norms that we want to reimagine. And I use the word reimagine because innovators use that a lot. It's a space that allows you to remove your psychological limitations or create psychological safety that would allow for people to believe they can do things differently. And then we as outsiders come in and show them this is possible because there's actually a vehicle that will allow us to. And each time there's a success, then it starts to incrementally change how they view the work. I'll give you one prime example. One of the departments that we ran a challenge with, it had all sorts of infrastructure and technical pieces that I won't get into, but at the beginning, they're very skeptical. They're like, oh, we get all these consultants. People are pitching ideas all the time. They say they can help us innovate. So, like, why should we work with you? The good thing is, the mayor and the leadership said we want to try this. Fast forward a year later, they created their first internal innovation unit. By working with us, they realized, oh, there's a completely different way that we should be approaching solving problems. Instead of these one-offs, we need to create a flywheel internally that centralizes innovation efforts and can help really support the different business units around the innovation integration process. And so that's a prime example of like, that's a real culture shift to go from skepticism to now adopting and creating your own FTE and innovation hub within a department demonstrates that it's not just about the challenge and the technology that we're helping them procure. It's also about the infrastructure, both culturally and technically.
So, what are the efforts been to bring this to other counties, in the state?
So we're actually looking beyond the state of Florida. The goal is to look at what markets would be a good fit. And I would say the efforts have been opportunistic. So we've had a lot of inbound and we haven't hit go yet to say we are actually open for business. We want to make sure that the blueprint that we can deploy for other markets to adopt and adapt is refined. And so we have a pipeline of active conversations, but more likely than not, we won't hit go until probably Q4 of 25 or even Q1 of 2026, when we are really ready to find the best first and second, maybe third markets for us to expand the model.
I heard you loud and clear. There's a lot of inbound, but are there opinions within NDIA right now as to what's going to, or what the team thinks will prove to be a great profile of another municipality that there'll be success?
Yeah, I think the profile is really along the readiness factors. So, do we have the right internal champions from the policymaker and the chief executive of that municipality? So, do we have the appropriate buy-in? Do we have the right leaders, even at the departmental level, that would be great for those first couple of innovation challenges? Are they open to trying something new? Also, do they have kind of the budget to allocate towards launching an innovation authority? And are the right partners in place? What I didn't mention is our work is really driven by a network of more than 120 external organizations that we've built over the last year and a half. These are investors, these are incubators, these are accelerators that actually have access to the startups that are solving the challenges that government needs to connect with. And so part of it is looking at how do we leverage our existing network, but expand to that local ecosystem to make sure that there's all the pieces in place. But I would say leadership, capacity, and then really the economic pieces and the right market that they are interested in really innovating are the top, indicators for our team.
Great. Earlier, you mentioned making investments, checks of 100,000. So once the capital is deployed, what's the degree the MDIA is assisting or working with the companies that receive the investment?
That's a great question. So we actually had our first tranche of closed pilots, so pilots that were completed, that I think at least one or two of those companies is on that pathway to converting the pilot into a contract opportunity, which is always great from an investor standpoint. That means revenue coming in the door. But in terms of support, we're not a formal program. We believe that what startups actually need are real opportunities to validate product market fit with customers. They don't need to be mentored. They don't need a bunch of classes or workshops. And so we try to check in with our portfolio companies around additional fundraising efforts. So we often will talk to prospective investors about our experience, about what we looked at in our due diligence that could be helpful in their decision making. We also have learned that what is reported out as the results of our pilots have been really helpful to our startups in generating new business. I talked to one of our founders of portfolio companies about 2 weeks ago, and she had mentioned that the pilot opportunity had generated more than 40 like really warm, good leads of municipal and government customers, and that had translated into 5 new contracts.
Wow.
So we follow up with our companies to see how they're doing growth-wise to help unlock new opportunities for further follow-on capital. And then also just to check in to see if we can be helpful in general.
I love it. That's brilliant. Leanne, I genuinely appreciate your time. I learned a ton. Been a couple references of lessons learned over the years, but if you had the opportunity to go back to the very beginning, have a conversation either with the 4-year-old or the high school or the college student, anything in particular that you would insights or wisdoms you would share?
So I spend a lot of time with young people through my personal nonprofit, and one of the pieces of advice that I often give is to remember that your platform is not your purpose. A lot of times the people will focus on their job or the platform by which they are having an impact in the world as their sole focus. But I encourage people to figure out what is it that you're here to do, and what are the right relationships that you can invest in to help you discover that? Because your purpose is not something you discover in a silo. It's often discovered through interactions with other people. So I always say my personal model is people, purpose, and impact over everything else. I really encourage people to focus on why they're here and not to conflate what they're doing with their why.
I think that's great. The way I so agree. One of the ways I've kind of thought about is, it's this definition of a calling. And I've always thought of it as, what is that thing that you would do even if you didn't get paid for it?
Precisely.
Helps, does a really great job of separating the wheat from the chaff. And answering the question is brilliant. Agreed. Leanne, anyone in your personal or professional life who's had a positive, meaningful impact on you over the years that you'd like to give recognition to?
That is a great question. There are so many people. But one I'd have to say is a friend of mine. He sits on the board of my nonprofit, who is a marketing genius. My friend Arturo Nunez. He is someone that has helped me recognize that being a multi-hyphenate is not a bad thing. He is not only a kind of serious person in corporate America, a person that sits on public boards, but he's also obsessed with music and is a serial entrepreneur and is a genius of thinking about how culture and storytelling can drive love and affection for brands. So I definitely say Arturo Nunez is someone that makes me think that I can do much more than I am currently doing all the time.
Wow. Well, shout out to him. That's amazing that he inspires you like that. And yes, you come across these individuals who just have amazing capacity. In my case, they make me feel inadequate. But when they motivate us to be our best selves, totally agree. Can't help but recognize them. Leanne, if there are anyone in our audience who either like to learn more about MDIA or get a hold of you, how can they find you?
So for me personally, I spend a lot of time on social media, unfortunately too much time, but you can always find me at leanne.buchanan on Instagram, on LinkedIn, or my website personally, which is leannebuchanan.com. In terms of MDIA, you can find us online at www.mdia.miami and also at MDIA on most social handles.
Fantastic. Leanne, thank you so much. I genuinely appreciate your time and sharing your focus at MDIA and your life experience with us.
Thank you, Christian. This has been so much fun. I appreciate.
My pleasure. And again, for the benefit of our audience, Leanne Buchanan, President and CEO of MDIA, the Miami-Dade Innovation Authority. Again, I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of FinStrat Management. Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. Take care. Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. If you are a successful founder or an investor, would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com/podcast-guest. If you've got something out of this interview, please share this episode on social media. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovators and Investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. Would you like to know more? Go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is @finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.